issues that you'd like me to speak about? Any kind of thing that you'd like me to weave into my Dharma talk? Be brave. I won't bite. No? Okay. Do you all know, like, is this anyone's first time at a Buddhist talk? Do you all know what Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana are? No? No idea? Okay. Beginner's mind. Alright. Okay. Theravada, found in... It's good, you know, it's good just to have a... Even if you don't want to, you know, take up Buddhism per se as a religion. Many people are adverse to religion nowadays. They have religuenza or something like that. It's just good to have a clear idea of a roadmap of Buddhism. Just so you know, okay, this is where I am. This is where I want to go. This is the path. Yeah? So... Theravada is found in Southeast Asia. It means the way of the elders. Okay, so it's a very simple, direct form of Buddhism. It probably most resembles what the Buddha taught in historical India. Yeah, and if you just are fed up with life, fed up with suffering, fed up with samsara, fed up with delusion, then this is the vehicle for you. Yana, yeah, yana means vehicle. You know, and basically they use as their main source the Pali Canon, okay, which is in Pali, obviously one of the languages spoken at the time of Buddha. And, you know, it doesn't talk much about the ideal of the Bodhisattva. Bodhi, enlightened, Sattva, being the spiritual warrior who strives not only for their own awakening, but for the awakening of all beings, yeah? That's more a Mahayana, Maha, great, Yana, vehicle, found in North Asia, China, Japan, it's found in Taiwan now, Mongolia, Korea. Zen is also part of Mahayana, yeah? Pure Land, all of these schools belong to Mahayana. In the Pali Canon, it doesn't mention bodhisattvas much, yeah? Except to say that the Buddha was one in his past lives. He was striving for the liberation of all beings, not just for his own liberation. So, you know, most Theravadins, although I do know a few Theravadin monks and nuns who have bodhisattva vows, most that I know aim for self-liberation. Because it's not easy to become a Buddha. It takes quite a while. But, you know, I don't know. I think sometimes it's worth it. Just depends on, you know, what you feel you can handle. Some of you maybe just want to be happy and you don't know why the hell I'm talking about all these different yanas. But don't worry, I won't go on for too long, I promise. And then Vajrayana. What is this? Not real Buddhism at all. So, you know, unfortunately what happened with Buddhist history, you know, white Europeans went to Sri Lanka and then wrote Buddhist history, you know, from a white kind of Theravada point of view, and they think that Tibetan Buddhism is a kind of perversion of Buddhism, and that it's like being incorporated with shamanic practices. Like I'll go to you know, a temple in Thailand, and they might tell me you know, that your Buddhism isn't real Buddhism. And I'll just say, well, thank you very much. See you later. I don't know how to work this thing. I think it's working. Yeah. So, a few stragglers. Okay, so actually that's not the case. Vajrayana came from India, okay? And it's just an esoteric form of Buddhism, of Mahayana Buddhism. The goal to become a Buddha is what is a Buddha? Buddha means awakened one, or in Tibetan, Sangye, Sang, to perfect all that has been perfected, all that needs to be perfected, like compassion, wisdom, etc. Then to abandon all that needs to be abandoned, yeah, like egotism, pride, anger, all of this, you know, attachment, all of these things that you know basically stop you from being happy anyway. these kind of hang-ups, you know. And the basic idea of Vajrayana is that you purify negative karma of body by visualizing the archetype, the form of an enlightened being. It's not a god, it's just an archetype. The Buddha was just a human being, not a god, yeah? You can become a Buddha, okay? There's a Buddha just at the end of your nose. There's a Buddha in this moment, just waiting to be born. Okay, so... and then we say mantras. Mantra is... man is mun, mind. Tra is to tie. To tie the mind to virtue. To focus the mind, yeah? And it's just a sound, an energy in the form of sound. And... it purifies negative karma of speech. And then in order to purify negative karma of mind, we merge our mind with the Buddha's mind. In the end, we realize that the archetype we're meditating on, Medicine Buddha, Avalokiteshvara, Kuan Yin, whatever, that is our own mind's nature. And our own mind's nature is emptiness, is ungraspable, yeah, beyond words. So that's the idea of Vajrayana, you know. And this was taught, you know, kind of... It wasn't, like, you know, not everyone's ready to just come into a room and be told, yeah, you're a Buddha, and you just need to clean your mind and you'll be fine. Not everybody's ready to be told that. Some people need to say, okay, if you don't practice, you're going to go to hell, and you should get your life together, and don't make bad karma, and, you know, all of these kind of things. You're going to die, so you better get your act together. Stuff like that. Some people need a bit of a stick, you know. So... Vajrayana was taught in secret, not because there's anything perverted about it, but because it can be easily misunderstood. You know, like you can go into these Tibetan Buddhist centers and you'll see a Buddha in union with a woman, and you'll think, "What is that?" Like my friend once had this Buddha statue with a we call it yabyum, with a female in union with a female, and she brought it out at the Thai kind of officers went through her. Through her bag, and they found this, and they said, "This is not Buddha," and they took her down to security, you know, and they kept her there for 5 hours. And in the end, she thought she was going to go to jail, because for them it's a perversion. Yeah, there's this symbol of purity, and then in union with this woman, you know, the very opposite of, because Buddha said, you know, desire is the path that leads you to delusion. You know, so for them it's like some kind of terrible kind of. What's the word, like, yeah, that's it, yeah, my vocab's gone down since I've been living in India. Yeah, so in the end, you know, they said, they gave her back the statue, and they said, "You never come to Thailand again." She was so scared, and, but actually it's just symbolic, yeah, that's the thing. If you're just going to a Vajrayana temple and you don't know, you don't have a proper teacher, then you can just think, great, you know, I can just indulge myself, I can do whatever I want, and I'll become a Buddha. But, you know, if that was the case, we'd all be Buddhas by now, wouldn't we? So, we tried it and it didn't work. I can testify, I was a hippie, I did everything. And, you know, in the end, it was like Janis Joplin said, yeah, freedom's just another way of saying nothing left to lose. But it was fun for a while. Yeah, so, you know, the woman is wisdom, intuition, and the male is active compassion, skillful means. And the fact that they're in union means it's actually the very transcendence of desire. Passion is transformed into compassion. And it's the very opposite of attachment or delusion. You know, so it's symbolic, yeah. And it means on the spiritual path, those two, wisdom and compassion, should be united as one. You know, and there are like some tantric texts and they say things like, kill your father, rape your mother. You know, and what does that mean? That means, sometimes men are said to, men are a symbol of anger sometimes. And a woman is symbolic of wisdom. So it means kill anger and become intimate with wisdom. But for those who are not versed in this secret language, It's like climbing into a jet plane and trying to fly it without an instructor. That's why in Vajrayana, diamond vehicle, adamantine, unbreakable vehicle, that's why you need a teacher, a guru, to guide you, because it's very swift, but it's also more easily to crash, more easily to go wrong, to misunderstand. And in Vajrayana, you take the result as the path, the result of Buddhahood as the path, and you transform, instead of throwing away emotions, you transform them. You just recognize, my mind's gone in the wrong direction, or we say it went round the wrong channel. And then you just try, because you just think when you're angry, all that energy goes into being angry, and then you're very tired, or you're depressed. And all your energy goes into that, and you can't, you feel very low energy, But if you can purify that, if you can work with that, and reintegrate it back into your system. I don't mean act on it in a raw sense. That is never appropriate. Raw desire or raw anger, raw attachment. It's not an excuse to indulge yourself. But to work with that, rather than cutting it off, like we say that Theravada is like finding a poisonous tree. You cut it from the root, There's nothing you can do with it. So you have this ego, this self-clinging, this delusion, these negative emotions. You just cut it from the root, dig it out, so it can never grow again. Cut it off. Mahayana is like, okay, we can use this tree to give shade to others. And they build a fence around it, and it gives shade to others, with a warning. Poisonous tree, enjoy a picnic. So it's like a bodhisattva. A bodhisattva still has someone who is striving to become a fully awakened being, who is compassionately motivated to liberate others, As long as space remains, as long as there are beings who suffer, I too shall remain in compassion to remove the darkness of the world. This is the vow of a bodhisattva, It's very beautiful, actually. I can think of nothing more beautiful in the world. It's true love. Just think, do you really have love? Okay, just close your eyes for a minute and imagine your boyfriend or girlfriend saying to you, darling, I'm in love with our best friend. I hope you don't mind. I think we'll be very happy together. And now just look at your reaction. Are you angry or are you happy? Now you know whether you have romantic love or real love. And you know that maybe you have a bit of work to do on your love. Yeah? Because love wants the freedom of all things. Don't make your love a cage. I'm not advocating like, the swinging 60s or anything like that. I think it's very important to be committed in a relationship, because that is a very sacred thing, you could have a baby from that relationship. You could give AIDS to each other. You need to be very responsible, actually, about how you... It's a very intimate thing. If you're emotionally healthy anyway, sex is a very intimate thing. And it should make you feel very close. And it should only be done when there is a real commitment and love there. And a long-term commitment, But, at the same time, don't lay your trip on someone. Don't put all your expectations on them to make you happy. They're not enlightened. How can they make you happy? They can barely deal with their own mind. It's a big, heavy trip to put on somebody, You're going to make me happy for the rest of my life. No wonder we have a 50% divorce rate. That's why I'm a nun, I just thought, well, until I can deal with my own mind, I can't handle someone else. like one lama said, one crazy mind, very difficult. Two crazy mind, even more difficult. But I think it's possible. Because maybe you can only learn about big love by maybe the microcosm can't understand the macrocosm without fully integrating the experience of being a microcosm, if you know what I mean. You can't really understand big love if you haven't experienced small love. You know that feeling that you really would do anything for someone, that you'd die for them, that you really want them to be happy, So maybe you can, from that experience, and yet it's funny how quickly it can fade if you break up with someone, isn't it? It's disturbing. Like you think that one minute you're thinking, I'll die for you, and the next minute it's like, I don't even want to see you. And you're fighting over the cat. Who gets the cat? Or the gerbil. Give me my gerbil. You sadistic. It's quite silly, really. Or the goldfish. So. Anyway. Anyway, I'm digressing a bit. But yeah, that's the basic idea. Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. Different strokes for different folks. Yeah, but obviously I'm biased. I'm a Vajrayanist, Mahayanist, so I want to encourage you all to think about liberating all beings from this cesspit of samsara. But, you know, go where you will. I'm not giving you a subliminal message or anything. Okay, but tonight we're talking about compassion, yeah? So compassion is like the oil that smooths the friction of life. And sometimes we think of compassion, actually in the West we don't really know what it is, I don't think. Maybe in medieval Christianity they did a bit, but it's been a long time, and, you know, since the 60s everybody's been so selfish, I think we've kind of lost all perspective of compassion. Because it's all about me, 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 isn't it? You know. But, you know, in the end most of us realize that living just for ourselves is very limited and very frustrating, and we feel cut off from the world. You know, I know so many young people who are going through depression. It's very normal, you know. They say by 2020 depression will be the most common illness in developed countries. There's a real lack of meaning, you know, in especially amongst young people, you know, people just aimlessly kind of taking drugs and having affairs, and just a real lack of inner substance, you know, and a feeling of being totally lost, I think, you know. But I'm the last person to kind of preach morality without any kind of inspiration. You can't just preach morality to young people and, you know, kind of without, you have to convey to them, pass on to them the wisdom of their culture in a way that they can relate to. You know, you can't just say you should do this, but you have to convey to them the inspiration, the joy, the inner meaning. And once they have that, then they'll automatically take up ethics, or, you know, give up harmful ways of life. Do you see what I mean? Yeah. And, you know, when you're at university, it's very nice because you're very idealistic, yeah? You really, that's why I always love just coming and seeing uni students, because they really think they can change the world. And then you just get out into the real world and you realize, oh, it's not as easy as I thought. And before you know it, your children are telling you, it's all your fault, you screwed up the world, look at what the world you're giving us. Well, maybe money does make the world turn, but love makes it worthwhile. You know, without love there is no point. Like, why do people go out to work, pay off their mortgage, you know, go through all this difficulty? Mostly it's because they've got someone that they love, you know, their kids or their partner, you know, that's something that they want to build a nest for, something that they feel is worthwhile, yeah. You know, so actually love is very important. Humans need each other, we're social creatures. Yeah. So, but compassion isn't just feeling sorry for someone. Compassion is, it's a sense of being able to walk a mile in another person's moccasins or shoes. Yeah, they say you can never judge someone until you've walked one full moon in their moccasins, this Native American saying, yeah? And it's understanding only to the extent that you've understood your own suffering, that you've untied your own knots, can you reach out to others. Only when you understand, just as I suffer, they too suffer, just as I want to be happy, they too wish to be happy. And it's not just kind of looking down on somebody, or, you know, wanting to, oh, there's poor people that I must help, there's poor unfortunate, because I'm so fortunate and I've got all the answers and now I'm going to prophesize and help them, you know. Sometimes it's a bit like that as well. But that's not compassion. Or giving with expectation. You know, like you work so long with this person who's an alcoholic, you counsel them, and then finally they go back to drinking and you're like, because you were giving with expectation, you know? Sometimes our parents, you know, they do what they think is best for us. You know, they put us through they make us become, you know, an engineer or a doctor, when actually we want to be a piano player or an artist, you know. And they, because they don't know, you know, they only, in a way, maybe they're living out their own life through you, you know. Maybe they, you know, but you have your own life. You have to find your own way, you know. It's very important. I wish everybody would just take a year off after they finish school and go traveling and find what they want from life. I certainly didn't know what I wanted from life until I was about... It took me till I was about 30 to decide, if I wasn't a nun, what job I'd actually like to do, you know. But there's a wonderful text called The Bodhisattva's Way of Life, which is like a Mahayana Bible, if you like. A guide for fearless living. Yeah? And, yeah. So, some nice sayings from it, if I can find them. Since I and others are the same in wanting happiness, what difference is there to distinguish us, that I should strive for my own happiness alone? Since I and other beings both, in wanting to give up happiness, are equal and alike, what difference is there to distinguish us, that I should save myself and not the other? And therefore I'll dispel the pain of others, for it is simply pain, just like my own. And others I will aid and benefit, for they are living beings, just like me. It's pretty elementary, really. It's pretty simple, but it's hard to do. We talk about compassion, but we don't know how to actually practice it. What are the steps, you know? Because most of us feel limited and frustrated by ourselves, isn't it? The older you get, the more you realize, you know, there's just only so far you can go with this self. In the end, it's kind of more of a hindrance than a help, you know. When I was young, I went to acting school, and I loved being in the limelight. You know, I loved, like, people paying attention to me. It gave me such a big thrill, you know. And then you'd have to do more and more big things to catch people's attention. But in the end, I realized, you know, that, like, when the lights turned off, who was I? Did I just live for that moment when other people acknowledged me? And I realized there was a lot of junk in my head. And what kind of example was I to others anyway? And then I realized I didn't know anything, you know. And then I just kind of wanted, I didn't want to act anymore. I didn't want to be the best or the loudest or the most noticed. I just wanted to be nobody going nowhere and just go into the inner silence and deconstruct this big ego. Because when you have an ego, you need people to support it, don't you? Friends who buoy you up, and then you have enemies because there's people who threaten your ego. So you create all this bad karma and all this attachment. You know, it says here, we're at 253, I think. If I long and crave for other beings, a veil is cast upon the perfect truth. Wholesome disillusion melts away. That means renunciation, the mind of being fed up with samsara. And finally, there comes the sting of pain, means death. My thoughts are all for them, means the ones I love. I'm just obsessed by them, thinking, giving all my time and energy to them. And by degrees, my life is wasted away. My family and friends all fade and past. Giving up, pursuing happiness in them, my chance of enlightenment is destroyed. And that doesn't mean what does that mean, Sister Yesha? That's pretty heavy. Does that mean that I have to give up my loved ones and go to a monastery and, you know, be celibate? Not at all. It's nice if you can, to do it full time. But most people are not ready for that or suited to that. But what it means is to be able to put your love in perspective and know that you can't expect another person to give you everything. You have to have your own life, your own dreams. And not just live for yourself, but to live for everyone. Because we're all interconnected, yeah? They are many and you are just one. And this limited self is very frustrating. It's not the way to peace, actually. You know, look at people like the Dalai Lama, Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa. They're all thinking about other people, yeah? And they're all full of happiness, always smiling, always laughing, yeah? Mother Teresa's face is like a prune, isn't it? Full of lines, but just full of love. That, to me, that is true beauty. Because the only beauty that does not fade is a kind and compassionate heart. Why would I want to look like a 12-year-old girl? You know, who doesn't know herself? Why would I put that as my ideal of beauty? I prefer someone who has some inner strength, some inner character. You know, why not grow a little bit deeper? It's a shame that our society values such a shallow ideal. And compassion brings joy, actually. If you have compassion, everybody wants to be your friend. Everybody likes to be around you. Everybody you meet is a friend, just a friend you haven't met yet, rather than a threat. Because there is, this ego is diminished, so there's nothing to defend. So everybody is, the door of your heart is open to everybody. That doesn't mean that you're like what I call a compassionate idiot, where you're like, walk all over me, I'm a martyr, giving money to alcoholics and, you know, wasting all your time for fruitless causes. Yeah, you need wisdom and compassion. You need to know, is this really skillful? Is this really helping this person? Will this help them in the long run to get enlightened? Yeah, because the problems of the world are really endless, like waves on the shore, always breaking. And you can break yourself if you try to be some kind of bodhisattva without any kind of inner resources. You know, but don't just, you know, sometimes I see these Buddhists and they become more kind of selfish. You know, they're not connected to the people around them. They're not generous, they're not kind, you know. And that happens more as we get older. You know, my practice, my own, my love, my precious. Yeah. You know, you want to know my analogy, my Buddhist analogy for the Lord of the Rings? Okay. The ring is the ego or ignorance. Yeah, it must be destroyed. And Frodo is like every man or woman who finds themselves thrust onto the spiritual path without a choice, because dukkha, suffering, is, you know, they have no choice basically. They must dissolve this ego, this ignorance. Yeah. And it's not a journey that they really want to make, but they really have no choice. And Gollum is like a person who has been overtaken by the ego, yeah? Who is being totally ruined by it. You know, I mean, look at a person who's been an alcoholic for many years or a heroin addict. They become like a ghost, you know, consumed by their own craving. That's endless, yeah? And then Galadriel is like the Dakini element, the semi-wrathful female enlightened being of wisdom, yeah, representing like the free and the luminous. And then Gandalf is like the guru, the spiritual guide, yeah, and he'll come and go. In the end, you yourself must walk the road, yeah. And Aragorn is like the bodhisattva, the spiritual warrior, who is helping the spiritual seeker on their way. But basically, it's in our best interest. The Dalai Lama said, even if you're the most selfish person in the world, it's in your best interest to be compassionate, because only compassionate people are truly happy, have a sense of meaning in their life. You know, it's wonderful to wake up and think, Waking up this morning, I smile. 24 brand new hours are before me. I vow to live fully in each moment and to look at beings with the eyes of love. It's much nicer to think about that than like, oh my God, what did I do last night? You know? There's a vast, and just like, okay, when you're in love with someone, your love is limited to one person, and doesn't that feel wonderful? But imagine if you're in love with all sentient beings. It's not for no reason that we don't become monks and nuns, you see. Yeah, it's very, actually very blissful, you know. And then you say, well, Sister Yeshe, if I love them, it means I also suffer with them, isn't it? So there's a double-edged sword there. But the suffering is very small, and the love is very strong, very great. So it's very worthwhile, actually. It's very possible, very doable. And another thing you should know is compassion is a verb. Yeah? You have to walk the talk. It's not just something you write about and eulogize like me, you know, a pathetic try-hard Buddhist, but actually something you, and it's not something that you go out as some kind of missionary because you feel insecure about your point of view and therefore you have to convince others in order to feel comfortable that you really believe it. It has to, you know, naturally, when you're ready, by the power of your practice, by you touching peace, by you unblocking the spring of compassion in your heart, will people feel drawn by that, affected by that? So it's work that you have to do on yourself. But there is a clear way to develop this this bodhisattva logic, if you like. You know, there's two ways basically. One is the meditation on the kindness of the mother or the beloved, you know, like the grandmother or whatever. A lot of Westerners have a lot of Freudian hang-ups about their mothers. Yeah? Isn't it? So, but you know, actually, I really couldn't stand in the same room with my mother when I was a teenager. We always, and still sometimes, she really gets on my nerves. You know, she's really quite neurotic in a very loving and adorable way. You know, like she stays up late last night and she's worrying about, you know, things that even I don't worry about. You know, like, how are you going to get all the money you've raised to India? So I'm like, oh, Mum. But, you know, she'd give her life for me. She loved me. She gave me so much. She gave up her life for me, you know. So how can I turn my back on that kind of kindness? And when I just started thinking about it, I realized, yeah, she made some mistakes, you know. But, you know, overall, she was a great mother. If you can just get your childhood without being sexually abused and, you know, dropped on your head and stuff like that, you know, you've done a great thing. You know, some of the people that I've spoken to over the years, they've had the most crappy lives, you know. So really, yeah, just think about the kindness of someone that you love very much, and that can really touch the spring of compassion in your heart and take you beyond yourself. That's the beauty of compassion. It takes you beyond yourself. It's a way, it's like emptiness. It's like the sword of emptiness that cuts through the suffering and the illusion of separateness. Yeah? So Buddhist emptiness is not nothing. It's not a big black hole. And it's not, we're not saying we're all one, you know, because when I get enlightened, you may not, or vice versa. We all have our own mind stream. We say mind stream in Buddhism, not soul. Because you can never put your foot in the same river twice, yeah? A river is a constant flow of awareness. And the mind is the same. Are you the same mind you were a year ago or when you were five? No, you have a continuity, but it's completely ungraspable. You can't find it anywhere. And it's changing moment to moment. It's conditioned by cause and effect. And yet there's a part of you that has never been born and will never die, and is luminous and spacious like the sky, vast and uncontrived. And that's why all the hard work, the meditation, is worth it in the end. You know? And some people say to me, well, what's the point? What's the point of life? You know, what's the point in making effort about anything? You know, everything's just blah. But actually, the point is you're suffering. So, you know, you know, you could kill yourself, but chances are you'll just have to come back, so why not get it right the first time? And I certainly don't endorse suicide, by the way. Have you ever seen that movie Groundhog Day? This guy has to live the same day again and again and again until he gets it right. Probably a bit past your generation. I'm getting a bit old. But you get the idea, yeah? Samsara is like that. Samsara means to circle. Yeah, the world of birth and death. So anyway, you can use this logic of repaying the kindness of your mother or, you know, your beloved. And then you say, okay, you get this real feeling in your heart of tenderness. And then you're like, okay, I have to repay their kindness. And then it's like, how can I repay their kindness? Because, you know, a trip to the Caribbean will never be enough. A big screen TV will never be enough because they're suffering in birth and death, you know. So the only way is to become a Buddha. You know, I'm not a Buddha. So that's what I have to do. I have to follow the path of the six perfections. Generosity, moral conduct, patience, joyous effort, staying on the path, you know, being motivated to practice, concentration, wisdom. And, you know, when you practice the six perfections, if you practice one, you practice them all. When you give, the best way to give is to know the person you're giving to is empty. The gift you're giving is empty. The person who is giving is empty. What do I mean by emptiness? Some of you know, some of you don't. Okay, it's a book. Okay, it seems like a book. We agree it's a book, right? But I set it on fire. It's not a book anymore. It becomes hydrogen. And it goes up into the sky. And maybe tomorrow it'll come down as rain. Yeah? Maybe it'll be breathed in China at the Olympics. I'm not sure. you know, so... It hasn't always been a book. It won't always be a book. Relatively, it's a book. No one's denying that. But ultimately, its nature is emptiness. Empty of true existence, solid, permanent existence. So it means it's full of everything. It has many non-book elements, like the publisher, the author, the logger, the tree, the rain, the moon, the sun, the mill, the petrol that went in the car to bring it from the forest to the mill to the office, the multinational companies, the virgin rainforest, the dispossessed tribal people. They're all part of this book. I hope no dispossessed tribal people, but you never know. And then, you know, maybe it turns into something else. Like maybe somebody thought this book was really crappy, so they used it as kitty litter for their. So it becomes something else, yeah. Or, you know, it goes back into recycling and is turned into a piece of furniture or an egg carton or who knows what. Or, you know, some kind of housing for. I've heard they can use it for like human habitat now. Maybe it becomes some of this recycled stuff. Even I've heard they can make plastic bottles into these fleece jackets and stuff. I saw it in a camping shop one day, you know. This used to be a plastic bottle. So everything is constantly being reincarnated. And you are no different, yeah? You have many non-self elements. Your mother, your father, the rain, the people that grow your food, the people that give you an education. All of these things, the people who inspire you. All of these things without which you wouldn't be the same. And you rely on the five aggregates, yeah? Which are like an onion. We seem real, but layer by layer, if you peel away each layer, in the end you can find nothing. And yet the onion is there, relatively. Ultimately, the nature of the onion is emptiness. It's interconnected with everything. But, at the same time, it appears for a certain period of time when the causes and conditions are right, and it will also pass away. Yeah. But your mind goes from life to life. But even your mind changes. Yeah, the mind of a dog isn't the same as the mind of a human, hopefully. Yeah. You know, a Labrador is the sweetest thing in the world, but, you know, I can't teach Dharma to a Labrador. I've tried. the logic of bodhicitta, the step-by-step, recognize the kindness of a beloved one, the need to repay it, the recognition that only a fully awakened being can liberate others from suffering. Because a Buddha knows, you know, why a pea is round and why a thorn is sharp. And, you know, to an old lady, you know, an old illiterate village woman, he might say, okay, just be mindful of your hands going down, letting the bucket down into the well. And by that mindfulness, eventually she becomes enlightened. She has a realization of things beyond words. And then, you know, to some uni student, he'll say, okay, here's the Abhidharma, the nature of the universe and its contents and its emptiness and, you know, volumes. Yeah. So a Buddha knows exactly your karmic history to liberate you from suffering. You know, the Buddha is the perfect physician, you know, the doctor that ends suffering. The Dharma is the perfect medicine, and the Sangha are the people who help you swallow the medicine. And the medicine, you know, you don't just take the medicine home and put it on your shelf and go om, 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 and shake joss sticks in front of it like they do in Thailand, you know, tell my fortune. You know, you don't just worship the Dharma, you practice the Dharma. And you don't mix your medicines. Follow one path clearly. You know, one week you're going to a Zen retreat, and the next week you're going to Theravada, and then the week after that you take some initiation. Can't remember the name of the Lama or the initiation you took, but you know you took something. It's not very good, yeah? Because, you know, they say in India, you know, you can't follow two shikaras, means boats. They might go like this, yeah? I mean, you can have what I call a side dish. Like, I'm a Tibetan Buddhist with a Zen side dish, because the master who ordained me as a fully ordained nun is Thich Nhat Hanh, a Vietnamese Zen master. But my main dish, I know what my rice and veggies is. Do you know what I mean? You need a main practice, a main teacher, a main lineage. Otherwise, you'll never get anywhere. Then the logic is, okay, so I need to become a Buddha. I practice the six perfections. And, you know, keep studying, keep understanding, get a clear idea of the path, make it a huge amount of merit and wisdom, the two accumulations of merit and wisdom. It takes three countless eons to become a Buddha by following the Mahayana. That's how long it took the Buddha. That's like, they say, okay, imagine there's a container the size of Sydney or the size of the city of Magadha, and every 100 years someone comes and throws a sesame seed inside, and when that pot is full, that's how long it takes to become a Buddha. So Vajrayana is supposedly a swifter path, but also you need a guide for that. Yeah, and it depends on your effort, actually. What you put in, so shall you. As you reap, so shall you sow. Or ye. So that's kind of bodhisattva logic. You know, and if we're all interconnected, the hand must help the foot, isn't it? You don't just kind of look at your hand and go, oh, it's bleeding, how interesting, look at the blood gushing out. You know, the hand must help the foot. So my friend, a society is only as strong as its weakest link. You know, so I help others simply because they are like me in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering. You know, and only by making my heart as wide as the world shall I become liberated from the sheath of selfhood. Sheath like a, you know, like a thing that goes around corn. That's a sheath. It's something that makes you feel cut off from life, as if you're wearing a raincoat on a sunny day. You feel a bit numb, a bit cut off. You don't, like, sometimes people have a lot of affairs because they're looking for this kind of intimacy, you know, and yet it just makes them feel further and further less intimate with people, more and more numb. Or they drink a lot, or they take drugs, they take risks because they want to feel alive. They feel numb. But all you have to do is just purify your mind, look into your own heart. It's all there. You know, you don't have to pay $1,000 and go to some big retreat. There's just enlightenment at the end of your nose, you know. Just like as Goenka says, observe. You don't know Goenka, otherwise you'd all be laughing. This Vipassana teacher, observe. Patiently and persistently. So I'm sure I'm making bad karma. I should stop. And then the other method of bodhicitta is exchanging self for other. So instead of, maybe you feel that your parents screwed you up way too badly to even think about them. So you're like, you use this logic, okay, all beings are more than me, I'm just one, and they are many. You know, and their suffering is more than mine. And, you know, the hand must help the foot. So likewise, they're like my body, you know. And as it says in the Bodhisattva's Way of Life, you know, the bliss or the joy that shall come when all beings are free, will that not be enough? Will it not satisfy? My own happiness, what is that to me? I mean, maybe your own happiness is a lot, but what kind of happiness are you looking for from the spiritual path anyway? You know, if you're looking for a quick buzz, then, you know, just take an acid trip, it's more easy. But if you're looking for real happiness, the kind that doesn't leave you with a hangover or a reduced brain capacity, you know, then cultivate compassion. It's a much more, what's this word, sustainable solution. Yeah. Yeah, there's actually a survey that says if you spend $10 on someone else or $10 on yourself, you'll be happier if you spend the $10 on someone else. Yeah? But of course you have to maintain your own mind. You're responsible for your own happiness, your own mind. You have to clean out your own mind. Only to the degree that you've practiced on the spiritual path, you know, can you liberate others. But then, you know, everything you do, you can see, if you invite the king, his ministers automatically come. If you aim for lasting happiness of liberation, then all the temporary happiness also comes. Yeah? But if you just aim for, if you just invite the minister, the king will never come. You know, so if you aim in a big way, then all the other small benefits also come. You know, but if you think in a small way, you'll only get a small result. And two people can be doing the same thing, you know. Maybe they put food in a monk's bowl, or they offer some candle to the Buddha, you know, or they just drop money in a Salvation Army box. Depending on their motivation, the result will also be, you see what I mean? If someone's just thinking, I just want to get rid of these old clothes, then the result is not very profound. But if they're thinking, you know, may I be food for the hungry, clothes for the naked, happiness for those who suffer, may I be a boat for those who wish to travel, a bridge for those who wish to cross the water, then, you know, that's much more deep, you know. Or if they're thinking, may I become a Buddha, then, you know, the Buddha said, all that we are arises with our thoughts we make the world, speak or act with a negative mind, suffering will follow like the cart that follows the ox, speak or act with a positive mind and happiness will follow like the shadow that follows the body. Yeah, so, I mean, all of these ideas, you know, electricity, computers, they all come from someone's mind, you know. So there's no reason you can't manifest Buddhahood. Why not? There was a story, maybe some of you have heard it before. This woman put a rice ball in the Buddha's bowl and she was so happy. And the Buddha said, in the future, by this merit, you'll become a Buddha. And she was so happy, she went home and told her husband. And her husband said, my God, there's nothing this monk won't stoop to get food in his bowl. You know, what kind of charlatan is he? So he was very angry. He went up and abused the Buddha and he said, how dare you tell my wife this just to get a bit of food in your bowl? It's terrible. You're a terrible monk. You're a shame to the name monk. And the Buddha said, he just listened, you know, very calmly. And then he said, friend, do you have a tree in your yard? And the man said, yes, I do. And the Buddha said, and how big was the tree when you planted it? And he said, well, it was as small as my little fingernail. And the Buddha said, and how big is this tree now? And he said, well, it's bigger than my house. And the Buddha said, well, if a seed the size of your fingernail can become a tree bigger than your house, why can't a rice ball become a cause for Buddha nature? Buddhahood. And the man was like... And then he said, can I offer you some food? He said, no. I only accept, I don't teach for food. I give purely to just to give. Mm. Yeah. You know, so we do waste a lot of time in this world, you know, in these samsaric distractions. In fact, you know, if you think about how much time you spend meditating, maybe some of you don't even meditate at all. Oh no! What to do? What doing you? So, really, how are you going to become a Buddha? You know, you're sitting there drunk, and all beings are waiting for you to practice the spiritual path. what can I say, you know? Just, you know, think about what you're doing with your life and how much time you've got left, that you could die at any time, because death is certain, the time of death is uncertain, and the only thing you can take with you when you die is spiritual practice. You can't take your friends with you, your family with you, your prestige, your bank account, none of these things. Your, you know, potted up Honda, Subaru, Turbo, whatever, your BlackBerry, your designer high heels, those beautiful instruments of torture, you know. So you can't take your degree with you, you know. The only thing you can take with you is spiritual development, you know. So make time, make Dharma a priority in your life, and develop concentration and wisdom. Yeah. And, you know, in they say in beautiful places, the haunts of stag and deer, make your home, with no one to mourn you when you die, with no shoes at the door, with no nagging inside. Happy is a yogi's life. Yeah. Make some time for solitude. Yeah. But make some time to help others as well. Because, you know, this human body is like the car, and merit, good karma, is like the petrol. You can't get realizations if you don't have good karma. Yeah. Do you have any questions?
I'm actually reminded of something that the story that was told about the Dalai Lama. And someone was waiting to see him, and was spending days waiting for the invitation to come through for the appointment, and was wandering around the village and saw a man savagely beating a dog, and was horrified, because she was a Westerner, she was horrified by the treatment of this poor animal. And then she went to the Dalai Lama and told the story, and then they got to talking, and then subsequently she asked him, Your Holiness, what is compassion? And he said, when you feel the same that you did for the dog, if you feel the same for the man as you did for the dog, the man who's beating the dog. And that's a lovely story.
Spaciousness. Everybody wants to know about Dzogchen and Mahamudra and advanced practices, and nobody wants to kind of talk about renunciation or refuge or any of the things that we actually need to practice right now where we are. But anyway, spaciousness. Well, I can't say that I have any great realizations, but basically spaciousness is the space between thoughts, isn't it? It's that place beyond words, where that quiet center of the storm. And when you've cleaned out your mind, when you've developed calm abiding meditation, then it's like the mind is like a candle in a glass container. It's still, yeah? And that with that spacious mind, you can illuminate whatever object you want to penetrate. And that's why you need a still mind to penetrate, to cut through the nature of things. That's why you need calm abiding first, in order to develop vipassana. And then when the mind is still, when the mind is... You can also... And also, you know, that's why you can see, if you can see the interdependent nature of things, you can see that everything is like in a constant state of flux. And then everything becomes, your life doesn't become so narrow anymore. It becomes very spacious and joyful. And you don't take anything or other people or situations so seriously. You become a child of illusion. And you can enjoy life without attachment, without a tainted mind. Your mind is so spacious. You can almost, you're free, you know. but most of us have a bit of work to do to get there. But it's possible. Is that okay?
Thank you. Could you tell us how you apply Buddhism in your work in India?
Are you Irish?
Yeah.
Oh, that's nice.
Thank you.
I like the twang.
I like your singing.
When my grandmother's born, the nursemaid said, "Oh, it's a weird Colleen." Okay, so most of these people have heard about it, but anyway, I'll go on about it again. You know, India is ruined by apartheid. Indian against Indian. You know, based on caste, that group you're born into, your life is determined, you know. So it's not always the case, you know. In the city, it's India is also a place of extremes. You know, there's second fastest growing economy in the world, and you know, some very rich and successful people, some great saints, some great activists. You know, it's not like every Indian is just kind of barbaric. You know, we're also very barbaric in many ways, but these people were the lowest caste, the Dalits. Dalit is the politically correct term. They were previously known as untouchables, because they did the worst kind of work. They carried excrement on their heads. They worked with dead animals. They, you know, cleaned toilets and swept paths and did, you know, any time a high caste person needed them to do something, they'd just drop what they were doing and they'd have to do it. Every 4 hours, a Dalit woman is raped. And just these people, you know, were living like animals, basically, until one of them got an education, became a lawyer, and, you know, became like the Martin Luther King Jr. of his people, led them out of slavery, if you like. I mean, whatever the African Americans went through, the Dalits also went through, you know. Even recently, you know, a family was tortured and raped and murdered for protesting about a high caste family building a road through their land without paying them. Even, you know, yeah, anyway, so then I just thought, yeah, you know, we have to. These people converted to Buddhism 50 years ago of their own free will to get rid of, you know, this kind of caste superstition and things like that. And it has helped them, because instead of being fatalistic and saying, you know, my life is in someone else's hands, it's my fate, I can't do anything about it, they're like, no, my life is in my hands, and I am equal, and I can achieve whatever I set out to achieve with the right causes and conditions, you know. So it's really changed their perception, and they're doing a lot better than many other backward castes, because they've changed their way of thinking. Because, you know, part of breaking the cycle of poverty is, you know, the mentality of poverty and the mentality of fatalism. So these people, I'm just very grassroots. I'm a very small charity, and I'm trying to build I'm raising money to try and build a monastery to offer counseling, to offer job training. We're sponsoring several students to study, especially women. Women are like another caste of untouchables in India. You know, many are women. I've seen so many suffering domestic violence. Of course, middle class, upper class women are just like us. But, you know, in poor families, like, I knew a little girl who was raped by her uncle and had to continue living there because her mother was divorced and had nowhere else to go. So she had to continue living with her rapist. And stuff like that makes me feel very angry, you know. But I've also seen, you know, the state of these men who drink and beat their wives, and often they can't find work, they're very frustrated. They were given a bad example by their father, who also beat and drank and beat their mother, you know. So it's like it's interconnected, you know. You can't just blame one person. But anyway, we're trying to help these people. We're trying to offer them teachings, meditation, job training, and maybe in the future we'll look at building some kind of cafe or you know, refuge for women who are escaping domestic violence, and also just to generate income and job training skills for women, and maybe some men as well. But our main focus at this point is to train women, you know, as an example of liberation, not to be married, not to become a domestic slave, but to be a social worker in the community, an example of independence and enlightenment, maybe I'm thinking a little bit in a revolutionary way, maybe they're not ready for that. I don't want to impose my white values on them. If they don't want to become nuns, that's fine. But we'll just do what we can and see what they're ready for and work from there. That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm trying to do. So I've probably gone on long enough. One last question?
Another question. I was wondering what you think the role money plays in, as a hindrance or as a benefit to compassion. And an example would be when you do something for somebody and then they will return the favour. You might build something and then they might provide you with a service, or the money is taken out of it, it's a relationship.
Mm.
And I guess where I'm coming from is just saying in the developed world, depression is going to be a very big illness.
Mm.
And I see that as potentially the individualistic way the capitalism is, that you know, you pay for your services and you get paid to do things for people, it removes that relationship that might exist in other countries, you know, more and more places.
Maybe. But, you know, just because people don't have money doesn't mean they're good.
No,
in fact, sometimes a lack of money can also mean a lot of lack of human dignity as well. And, you know, having lived without money for the last 8 years, I can tell you that there's a lot more I could have done had I had some money. It just depends on what you do with it, I think. But I also do believe that the resources of the planet are finite and we have to live responsibly, and we can't keep living the way we're living. You know, 80% of the world's resources in the hands of 20% of its population, and there is no free trade, basically. You know, Western countries subsidize their farmers so that people from developing nations can't compete. It's all unbalanced. And if everybody lived like an American, you know, we'd need 20 planets to support it. So it's not feasible. We are too greedy. And I don't think we're any happier for it. So I do believe that we have to simplify. You know, and I don't think you can have everything. You know, if you want enlightenment, you have to make time for that. We have to support people who want to pursue that ideal. You know, and I do think... I think it is nice, you know, it's true that... That's why I don't charge for Dharma. I just let people give what they want to give. But some people just give like 50 cents or something or nothing once I got a can of beans. But, you know, that's also okay. Maybe they don't feel what I gave was very valuable. but I've also, you know, never gone home with my bowl empty, even though I've stayed in St. Vincent de Paul hostels and on friends' couches, and it hasn't been an easy ride. That intimacy of just the economy of goodness, there's a lot to be said for that. But I don't think we should impose our, you know, Gandhian ideals on developing countries. You know, they also should choose their own way. And you know, a money, wow, you know, $500, I'm sponsoring a rickshaw waller's daughter, you know, those three-wheel bikes. I'm sponsoring her to study for a year. And she can lift her whole family out of poverty if she gets a job. So for them, you know, money can be the difference between a life of drudgery or a life of happiness. You know, and only when a person has a basic level of survival can they think about spiritual things. We're very privileged, you know. So for us, many things are possible. For them, not many things are possible. Anyway, I hope you enjoyed it. I hope you got something good out of tonight. It's okay. Happy you. Like him. Hang on.
Sorry. Sure.
Yeah, it says, is there any need for lengthy explanation? Childish beings look out for themselves, while Buddhas labour only for the good of others. See the difference that divides them. If I do not give away my happiness in exchange for others, enlightenment will never be attained, and even in samsara, joy will fly from me. It's very beautiful, actually. And then, you know, they say, like, just as a lotus slides down on a lotus lake, so shall a bodhisattva enter the deepest hell. You know, for them, there is no... their compassion is so immutable that... there is no misery for them to give their life to others. So be like that. Aspire to be like that. That is what life is all about, don't you think? And never believe that you can't make a difference in the world. Yeah. People that made a difference in the world always thought outside the box. Yeah. Follow your own heart. But follow the wise heart. If the heart is good, everything is good. Okay. So now, Buddhism is always good in the beginning, good in the middle, good in the end. Yeah? In the beginning, we set a motivation. I don't just do this for myself. I don't just do this for short-term happiness. I do this for the liberation of all beings. In the middle, it only leads to happiness and well-being. It's not a cult. There's freedom of thought. No one's imposing this on you. And in the end, we dedicate the merit. It's like a drop in the ocean. It will go on until all beings are liberated from samsara. I prostrate to the awakening of the Buddhas and their children, the Bodhisattvas. I rejoice in their spiritual levels of realization. I request those who are passing away not to, but to remain for countless eons, and to shine the lamp of Dharma for all bewildered in the gloom of ignorance. My friends will become nothing. My foes will become nothing. I too will become nothing. Just like a dream experience, whatever things I enjoy will become a memory. Whatever is past will not be seen again. The Buddhas neither wash bad deeds away with water, nor remove beings' sufferings with their hands. Beings are released through the teachings of the truth, the final reality. Thus, by the virtue that has collected through all that I have done, may the pain of all living beings be cleared away. Okay. Thank you very much. I hope your Dharma group flourishes. And for those of you who are interested, I have a charity. This is it. We have a fundraiser on the 23rd of August at the Buddhist Library. We would welcome your support. I have a teaching program if you're interested. You can take it.